Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. We are currently studying the book of Genesis. So open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
Here are the facts. Adam and Eve had two kids, the first two boys that are mentioned in the book of Genesis. The only thing we know about them in terms of their activity is that they brought sacrifices to God. It's all Moses took the time to tell us. Didn't say anything about their growing up. They are now apparently grown men. One's working in a field, one's keeping flocks, and they both bring sacrifices to God. Those are the facts. The question is, why is it that one of them knew to bring a sacrificial animal which God accepted? And why didn't they both know that? And why did one of them bring grain and God didn't accept it? Why didn't he know whatever it was his brother knew? Why did Abel know how to bring a sacrifice that God would accept? And why didn't Cain know? I mean, there's only four people mentioned so far in the history of all people. Why would God leave them in this state where one of them knew how to please him and the other just didn't? Election. There's nothing else you can say about it. Sovereignty. There's no other way you can face those facts. Again, there's only four people. And one of the two brothers managed to please God. And the other, God rejected his offering. He became angry and he killed his brother. And so the first two people born to Adam and Eve become the representatives of the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman. Because that is exactly what was promised in the Proto-Evangelium. Right away, God said, now that you have rebelled against me, now that the fall has happened, he separated all of humanity into the seed of the serpent or the seed of the woman, and he said that the seed of the woman was going to crush the head of the seed of the serpent. And now you've got two people, two offspring of the fallen couple, and right away you've got the division between the one God rejects and the one God accepts. And the only way you can explain that one of them got accepted, while they both deserve to be rejected, the children of fallen creatures, the only way you can say that God accepted Abel's offering and was pleased with it is to say sovereign election. You can't say anything else. Please, if you can think of anything else, tell me. What other explanation is there for the fact that one of them knew how to please God and God accepted his offering? And the other God rejected. Anything?
Not given the materials in the Bible.
No. And so, starting in chapter 4, let's just start at verse 1 and we'll pick up steam as we go past the stuff we looked at last week. Now Adam knew Eve his wife. We should take a moment there and talk about that word knew for a second, because it is an old English term that gets confused a lot in modern Arminian parlance. In the New Testament, Paul makes much of the fact that God foreknows. Whom he did foreknow, he did predestinate to be conformed to the image of his Son. Moreover, those that he did predestinate, them he called. Those he called, them he justified. Those he justified, them he glorified. And all of that activity began with the fact that God foreknew. And so our Arminian friends will get a hold of that and say, well, he knew something about them. He knew that they were going to believe. He knew that they were going to have faith, and therefore he did all that other stuff on their behalf. He predestinated them to be conformed to the image of his Son, and he called them and justified them and glorified them because he knew something about them. The problem with that thinking, of course, what is that, Romans 8:28 is, for we know that all things work together for good to those who love the Lord, who are the called according to his purpose. Launching into Romans 8:29, for whom he did foreknow, he also did predestinate to be conformed to the image of his Son. The problem with the interpretation that our Arminian friends proffer, that what this passage is telling us in Romans 8:28 and 29 is that God foreknew something about people, is that it's not what the text says. It doesn't say he foreknew anything about people. It says he foreknew people whom he did foreknow. not because he foreknew things about them, but he knew them in advance, whom he did, prognosko is the word, have intimate knowledge of in advance. Well, that kind of knowing is the type of knowing that we see throughout the Bible to describe intimate relationship. And that old English word, the very same old English word, is used here in Genesis 4:1 to say Adam knew Eve and she bore him a son. So we're not just talking about knowledge about her. He did not know something about her and she became pregnant. He had to know her in an intimate, loving fashion that created a unity of relationship and that produced offspring. And that's what that word means. So when you see it picked up again in the translations of Paul's word, prognosko, in Romans 8:28, they picked that word in specific because they were saying whom he had a relationship with in advance. Those are the people who he did all those other things for. There, a little extra theology thrown in for free there. Now, Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived, and she bore Cain, and she said, I have acquired a man from the Lord. Then she bore again, and this time his brother Abel. Abel was a keeper of sheep, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. And in the process of time, it came to pass that Cain brought an offering of the fruit of the ground to the Lord. And Abel also brought of the firstborn of the flock and of their fat. And the Lord respected Abel and his offering. And he did not respect Cain and his offering. And Cain was very angry, and his countenance fell. That's the whole story. That's all you get. You get five verses to describe that whole story. So there's nothing in here to tell us why it is that Cain didn't know what Abel knew. So we can only assume that God chose. Verse 6. So the Lord said unto Cain, why are you angry? Why has your countenance fallen? Verse 7 is where we left off last week. If you do well, will you not be accepted? Here it is right away. God is back to the elementary aspects of his relationship with fallen mankind. Men have fallen, men have rebelled, so he has to start right out by explaining to these human creatures who supposedly now are like God because they can determine for themselves good and evil, which did not make them good, it made them evil. They did not wake up and say, oh, now I know good and evil, look how good I am. They said, I realize good and evil, and I realize I'm bad. I realize I'm naked. And they went to work trying to cover themselves up, and they ran and hid. They didn't become instantaneously better. They became instantaneously worse. They thought they were going to become like God. All it did was draw them further from God because they were going to become self-willed, self-determinant. I'll do what I want to do when I want to do it, and I'll decide what's good and bad. God doesn't have to decide it for me. And so God starts explaining it in very basic terms. There is good and bad, and if you do well, the things you do well will be accepted. Now, that's even more fascinating to me because that means that his sacrifice that he brought, grain, the work of his hands, when he brought that in front of God in some form or fashion, it wasn't good. It wasn't well. It was sin in God's eyes. Why? See, there's all these big theological implications here. In what way can we say that him bringing that sacrifice, the work of his own hands, grain he tilled from the ground, he brought it to God as a sacrifice, and God didn't accept it. It made him angry, and God here says, if you do well, you'll be accepted, and if you do not well, which is what he clearly not done, then sin is at your door. So God is calling his sacrifice, which God did not accept, sinful. In what way was it sinful?
Pride of life,
works, yeah, because his sacrifice did not speak of Christ. Abel's sacrifice, as we saw last week, Jesus said it was prophetic. It spoke of Christ. It spoke of the reality that for sin comes death. What did Adam and Eve do when they realized they were sinful? They got to work, started making stuff, started covering up their own, making aprons, doing stuff, hiding from God, deciding for themselves. What did Cain do? Get busy, get to work, offer God what I've done with my hands. Here's my stuff. And God rejects that every single time. And yet, that is the theology that lays at the heart and soul of, I don't know, pick a percentage. 95%, is that too low a number? Of all supposedly Christian theology says God will accept you on the basis of works. Get to work. Get to work and do your stuff and God will accept you. But there's only one thing God accepts. If you get nothing else out of anything else I say tonight, get this. God accepts one thing only. His son. That's all he accepts. And so a sacrifice that does not bespeak his son and the worship of his son is simply not an acceptable sacrifice. You can bring your works all day long to God and go, here's my stuff, my works, my thing, my religion, my tradition, my activity, my, I'm part of this church and I never missed a Sunday and I'm on all these activities and doggone it, I'm an elder in this church. I mean, I need to get credit for something here, God. You get no credit for any of that, which is why Isaiah does lay it out so plainly and clearly that your best righteousnesses are filthy rags. And I have, for a long time now, avoided the actual translation of that phrase. And it's bloody menstrual rags, because that just makes us all go, oh. But it should. It should make you go, because that's what Isaiah was trying to do. He was trying to shock you into understanding that your best righteousness taken to God is filthy rags. So what do you have to recommend yourself? You've just got nothing. But the point is, God taught this when there were only four people on the planet. Two people, two boys, same parents. The only people on the planet. And one of them brings a sacrifice that says, I do. And one brings a sacrifice that says, something must die sacrificially in my place. And God has respect to one and calls the other sinful. I don't need more than that to adjust my theological thinking. Right? I mean, I can get the first four chapters of Genesis, and if that's all I had to work with in terms of my knowledge of God and what he was like, that would be sufficient to tell me, don't go to that God with your works. Don't go to that God with stuff in your hands and think he's going to accept you on that basis. As soon as Adam and Eve rebelled, what did he do? Slew an animal. Okay, that's a clue. That's God's reaction to sin. So what should your reaction to sin be? I'm a sinner. Slay an animal. But human ego, pride, flesh, sinfulness being what it is, it says, okay, the God way is that way. I'll improve on that way. I'll do it my way. And that's the beginning of everything we call religion. The I'll approach God my way. If you do well, will you not be accepted? That's so basic. And if you do not do well, sin lies at the door. And its desire, sin's desire, is for you. And you should rule over it. These are the basics. Sin's desire is to take you. That's just a fact. First people on the planet, first sinners, what does he say? If you don't do well, it's because sin is at the door. And its desire is for you. It wants to take you over. It reminds me of Jesus talking to Peter, saying Satan has desired to have you, that he can sift you like wheat. And if it weren't for the fact that Christ stood between Satan and Peter, he'd have had Peter. He'd have chewed him up and spit him out. But Jesus said, oh, I'm sorry, was that amusing?
No, I'm thinking about the curse to Eve. Your desire will be for your husband, but he will rule over you.
But he will rule over you, yeah. It's all part of that same fleshly, we don't want to be ruled over, not by anybody. God ordains an order. Here, let's put your concept in a New Testament framework. Paul says, here's the way we will structure the church. And it will include deacons and elders. And deacons and elders will not be women. And yet he speaks of women that have been helpful in the ministry, that have been his partners in the ministry, that have been a help. But he has said, I will not have women usurp authority over a man and teach in the church. That seems so basic. Is there any part of that statement that's complicated to understand? And so human beings naturally go, no, we're not going to do it that way. No, we're going to do it our way. And then justify themselves. Well, she's a very intelligent woman. And she clearly knows a lot about her Bible. And why would God give her this gift and ability to know her Bible and speak so well if he didn't want her to use it? It's the way human beings work. It's like, well, now God has gifted me with this ability. He must want me to use this ability. And he must want me to use this ability in a way that is in complete opposition to what he has already stated as a rule. That's how humans work. But it goes all the way back here. Because as soon as there were sinners, there were people going, I'll do it my way. My way's a little bit better. I can improve on the God way. And so God says, if you do well, you'll be accepted. If you do not well, sin lays at the door, and the sin desires to have you. So what's the response? Give in. Give in to the sin. Sin wants you. Roll with it. Which is far too often what we're seeing in the contemporary church. Absolutely. We have this great capacity to justify our sin and say it's not really sin. And say, sure, there's a godly way to do it, but I don't have to do it the godly way. I can improve on the godly way. The instruction, as soon as there was sin, immediately the instruction was, now look, sin exists, sin is at the door, sin wants to have you, resist it. And it's the resistant part that seems to be missing from so much of contemporary Christianity that, first off, doesn't admit sin exists. And if you're writing your best life now kind of theology that never talks about blood or sin, that never talks about atonement or sacrifice, that won't bother to tell you that God is holy and you're in trouble, well, then there's nothing in that package to tell you resist sin, because you've never brought sin up. It's not a subject. And so people are not only sinning willfully, they're sinning ignorantly, and they're sinning wildly with abandon because nobody's ever explained to them that sin is real and it exists and you have to resist it. You're to put these things off from you. But under the guise of Christian freedom and under the guise of every individual Christian's freedom of conscience, we want to think, well, I'm a Christian and I'm indwelt by the Holy Spirit, therefore I'm strong, so I can play with the evil thing. Because the evil thing can't hurt me because I'm strong, I'm a Christian. And so I will bring all kinds of strange fire into God's temple, and I'll be okay when I do that. And every peculiar, worldly, odd thing, I will somehow Christianize by the very fact that I, the Christian, am doing it. No. No, the biblical paradigm is God says what's right and what's wrong, what's acceptable, what's not, and he has always said that he has the right to tell you how to approach him. And if you approach him any other way, he has the right to say no. And so he has said there's one way you approach me, because there's one thing God accepts. He accepts his son. So the son would show up on the planet and say, I'm the way, I'm the truth, I'm the life. No man comes to the Father but by me. That's very inclusive, but it's also very understandable. It's not vague in the least. I'm the way, I'm the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father but by me. And right away, sinful people start going, well, what he's saying is there's a lot of ways to God. That's what he means. There's a lot of pathways to God, and there's a lot of religions, and every path is just as legitimate as every other path. That's what he meant to say.
And there's no truth.
And there's no absolute truth.
That means no truth.
No, truth is relative. Yeah, because, you know, Jesus said, I'm the truth, but what he meant was he has a truth.
Yeah.
And then you have your truth.
But there's no absolute truth.
There's no absolute truth, absolutely. Definitely, no absolute truth. I am sure of that. I'm absolutely sure that there are no absolutes. Absolutely. I'm the way, I'm the truth, I'm the way. No man comes to the Father but by me. Human beings do not like that idea. They want to believe that if there is a God up there, that he is some great cosmic marshmallow that just loves everybody desperately and wants everybody to come into his presence. And as long as you're sincere in whatever it is you do, he will accept you until you go back to Genesis 4. Again, I only need the first four chapters of Genesis to get my theology straight. Cain was very, very sincere when he walked up there with that offering. He took the time to do it. That's sincerity. He did it because he knew God existed. There wasn't any question about the fact that God existed and that God required a sacrifice. And he was very sincere in bringing that God a sacrifice. And God did not accept it. Does God have the right to not accept your sacrifice?
Sure.
I mean, I thought he just wanted everybody to do everything, whatever effort you put forward. He went, oh, close enough. Bless your little pointed head. Good job. You tried. Isn't that the way God works?
Nope.
Not the God of the Bible. The God of the Bible says, this is how you approach me. And if you approach me any other way, because I am God, I will exercise my right to say that you can't be in my presence. And we're okay with that on a human level. We're okay with that in the human sphere. I get phone calls that I look at the caller ID and go, that's not urgent, I'll call them right back. What did I just do? I just said, well, that person doesn't get my attention and presence right now. Everybody in the room is fine with that. If you show up at my door in the middle of the day, unannounced.
You're doing that to me, I'm not fine.
Now that you know? Yeah. Well, okay, I didn't mean to say it was Jennifer. But okay, so anyway, what I'm trying to say is whenever Jennifer calls, I look at the caller ID and I...
He answers my calls.
Callous. Nicely done. If you show up at my house in the middle of the day, do I have to answer the door? No, nobody has a problem with that. If you show up unannounced at my door and knock on the door and I don't answer, even if you see my car in the driveway, you'll go, well, I guess he's not available. Not going to answer the door. I guess I'll drive away. And we're okay with that. We are not offended by the fact that we are not allowed at this very moment to go talk to President Bush. That does not upset us because we know that's the way it is. If you pick up the phone right now and dial the White House and say, get me George, they're going to say, no. And we're all right with that because he has power. He's important. He's just a guy who we can vote out of office, but we agree that he has sufficient power, authority, and responsibility that your common people can't bug him or be in his presence because he's busy. How much more God? Shouldn't God have the same rights as, let's say, an elected official? Shouldn't he have the same rights as George Bush? Shouldn't he have the same rights to say, no, you actually cannot be in my presence? I know you're bringing me your junk and you're presenting it to me like it's valuable, but because I'm God and I make the rules, you only approach me through my son, and that's the only way you approach me. And if you try to approach me any other way, no matter how sincere you were about Buddha, I'm sorry, not my son. Do you understand what I'm saying? Now, my point is, I'm not saying anything that isn't as old as Genesis 4. This theology is so plain. It's been around for so long. It's said so clearly. And yet, how many years have we been arguing about it now? What, we got 6,000 years of recorded history, more or less? And we're still arguing about these things. Well, does God really mean that? Is that what I know he said it, but isn't there wiggle room there? Mostly Jesus? Give me Jesus mostly? That's a hymn we can write now. So the Lord said to Cain, why are you angry? Why is your countenance fallen? If you do well, won't you be accepted? And if you do not well, sin lies at the door, and its desire is for you, and you should rule over it. Don't let it take you. Don't let it run you. You should rule over it. Now, Cain talked with Abel, his brother, and it came to pass that they were in the field. Well, I love the way Moses just goes, bang, 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 fact, detail, detail, fact, bang, dead. He talked to his brother, which means he coerced his brother out into the field. Get you away from mom and dad, get you out in the field, kill you, nobody will ever know. And so he talked to Abel, his brother, and it came to pass. They were out in the field. Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and he killed him. Again, four people on the planet. Sin happens among the first two. The next two were born. Murder happens. That's how quickly sin gets a hold. Is it any surprise, then, that to this day you turn on the news any evening and you hear that a fight broke out somewhere and somebody yanked out a gun and somebody ended up dead? That's as old as Cain and Abel. People who can't work out their differences. Instead, it becomes, I hate you, so I'm going to kill you. That seems like the best answer. I'm just going to kill you. It's been around for as long as there's been people. And so the Lord said to Cain, where is Abel, your brother? Why? Because no matter what you do in the dark, no matter what you do in the fields, no matter what you do anywhere in God's creation, God knows. And Cain got his brother out there in the field because he thought that would be private. And he could hide him in the field, nobody'd ever know. But you can't hide anything from God. David would write later, though I make my bed in hell, you are there. You know my thoughts before I think them. You know my uprisings. You know my downsittings. You know everything about me. He said, you formed me in my mother's womb. I mean, God knows intimately, absolutely everything about you. And so God comes and asks one of those questions. This is the same kind of question that he asked Adam when he came walking in the cool of the day and Adam and Eve hid. And he said, Adam, where are you? Do you think God knew?
Sure.
Sure, of course God knew. So why is he asked the question? Doesn't it seem like kind of a pointless question? Everybody knows. Adam knows, Eve knows, God knows. Why would God ask the question?
To make him admit it.
To make him admit it. My daughter is so smart. I
get to eat tonight.
You get to eat tonight. Is it just me or did this take a weird turn?
It's your job.
Were you going to say something?
I have a small question.
Sure.
I'm having trouble getting my brain around the phrase, but you must rule over it.
Yeah.
To sin. Why would he tell Cain that you must rule over sin?
I think sometimes there are just axiomatic statements made in the Bible that are just plain, clear, for lack of a better word, didactic statements that are just realities. It's the same as statements in the New Testament like, God commands all men everywhere to repent.
Or your righteousness must exceed that of the
Pharisees. These are just facts.
Okay.
And so sin is either going to overtake you or you're going to get rule over it. Those are the two options. It's going to eat you up or you're going to get control of it. But those are the two options. Now, what happens as we continue toward the flood here? You're going to see that when God brings about the flood, it's because all the intentions and thoughts of the heart of mankind were only wickedness continually. So did they get any kind of rule over their sinfulness?
No.
Does that change the fact that they had to get control of it?
It's still their duty.
It's still their duty. Right. It's still a reality. Sin is going to eat you up or you're going to get control of it. What happened? It ate them up. But that doesn't change the fact that if you don't get control of it, it's going to eat you up, right? So those are just plain didactic statements. Can any human then, being a sinner, on their own, get control of their sinfulness?
No.
No, absolutely not. Isn't that everything the flood teaches us? And then God comes along and says, okay, what if I give you a bunch of rules to tell you what righteousness would look like if you could do it? And gives them the law. Here's what righteousness looks like. Go. No help at all. But were they still responsible for every sin that was in the law? Yeah, sure. He says, here, do these and I'll bless you. Don't do it, I'll curse you. Resulted in curse every time. Why? Because it's a reality. You either get control of sin or sin will destroy you. The import of that is, this sinfulness that you are being naturally born into is going to destroy you. And prior to Christ and the infilling of the Holy Spirit, human beings were completely, utterly powerless in front of the juggernaut of sin. And you see that in all of human history. But what that does, I think, because I always look at all of human history and the Bible through the lens of God's redemptive purpose, what that does is give you thousands of years of human beings striving and dying under the weight of sin, building to the necessity of a Savior. So that the Savior is not an addition. He's not an addendum. He's an absolute necessity. He is the center of all life. He's not gee, you're doing pretty well so far. Let me just help you out. Let me get you a boost, you know. He's not here to play leapfrog with you. It's like that, remember that Footprints poster that was so popular for a while? Where it says, I was walking on the sand and there were two set of footprints. And then for a while there was one set of footprints during my times of trouble. And so I asked the Lord, why in my time of trouble did you abandon me? And he said, no, those were the places I carried you. When I first saw that, I kind of went, oh, yeah, but I knew something was wrong with it. And I kept staring at it until I figured out there was never a place where there were two sets of footprints. Either he carried you the whole way, or he wasn't walking next to you. But as long as you have that cooperative concept that we were walking along together, me and Jesus, then when things got hard, I let him do the driving. But then it's us walking again. Yeah. My co-pilot, you know, he's just helping me out. If man could have accomplished anything where sin was concerned, then really what you needed was a co-pilot, a helper. But if God could use thousands of years of human history to prove that once sin came into the world, it destroyed everyone and everything it touched, then the Savior comes into the world like a beacon of light in pitch black darkness.
So this is really kind of the gospel also, because the only way we can rule over sin is obviously...
Undoubtedly, yeah. But again, what are we, four chapters into Genesis? Yeah. That was a really good question, and it gave me a chance to pull all that in, so I'm glad you asked. Verse 9, the Lord said unto Cain, where is Abel your brother? So that he had to admit. So what does he do? What all human beings do, lie. Lie. And then lie sarcastically. Notice he is sarcastic to God. And says, I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper? In other words, remember, you're talking about a guy who kept sheep, Abel. He was a sheep keeper. And so what he was saying was, is it my job to herd my brother and lead him around the way that he leads his sheep around? Sarcasm toward the God of ages. I do not know, am I my brother's keeper? By the way, what's the proper answer to that question? Yes, yes, in fact you are. Yes, you are your brother's keeper, yes. You actually are responsible for your brother. Yes. And God said, what have you done? Now look at this language. The voice of your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. How intimately in tune is God with his creation? The blood of the slain brother, he said, cried out to me so that I am fully aware of everything you've done, and you're going to pay. So now, verse 11, so now you are cursed from the earth, because the earth is where the blood was spilled, which earth has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. Human blood spilled on the ground, so God said, I am now going to use that ground to curse you. Here's the way the curse is going to go. Verse 12, when you till the ground, remember that's what he did for a living. He tilled the ground, grew things, brought that to God as a sacrifice. When you till the ground, it's no longer going to yield up its strength to you. You had that big bounty that you grew before, and you brought some of that in your hands to me, and I rejected that work. Well, now, because you've spilled your brother's blood on the ground is no longer going to help you. You're going to be a fugitive and a vagabond while you're on the earth. And Cain said to the Lord, my punishment is greater than I can bear. Now, we have to assume a few things here. We know from what we're about to read in the genealogy that Adam and Eve bore a lot of other children. We know that has to be the fact. They begin to populate the earth. Cain is going to have a wife spoken of soon. We have to assume that the wife is going to be one of his sisters, one of his siblings. There is nobody else. So he takes his wife, and he's going to go separate himself from Adam and Eve, who now have a dead child and a child who has left. So they're basically back to square one. as they've had these other children, and as these other children have grown and begun to populate that area, he realizes that by being driven off from all of them, he's going to be a genuine outsider. And that when later generations find him, see him, they're not going to know him, they're not going to recognize him, and so they're going to assume him to be an outsider, an enemy of some sort. So he realizes that his punishment is actually banishment from the whole human population that's on earth at the time. So he says, my punishment is greater than I can bear. Surely you have driven me out this day from the face of the ground. I shall be hidden from your face. I shall be a fugitive and a vagabond on the earth. And it will happen that anyone who finds me will kill me. That's his prediction of what his life looks like. From this point forward, I'm going to be a vagabond, I'm going to be a fugitive, I'm going to be sent out from all the rest of the people, and if anybody ever finds me, they're going to kill me. Also, by the way, I have to point out one other thing. Notice that God said, the ground's no longer going to yield up its strength to you, you'll be a fugitive and a vagabond on the earth. To which Cain replies, I shall be hidden from your face. I shall be a fugitive and a vagabond on the earth. Now, this is the same guy who a moment ago was arguing sarcastically with God. Notice how quickly he realized that whatever God said was it. God said, you're going to be a fugitive and a vagabond. And he did not argue anything about free will. He didn't say, well, I will be if I choose to be. He didn't say, no, God, I disagree. I'm going to do it my way. He didn't say, good suggestion, God, I'll think about that and get back to you. He immediately realized that the sovereign God said, this is what you're going to be, and he was that. And he admitted to it. This is what I will be, because this is what God has made me. And so, the Lord said to him, since he was afraid that anyone who found him would kill him, the Lord said to him, therefore, whosoever kills Cain, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold. In other words, God is trying to stop the killing. Cain, who has now killed, is fearful that when he's found, he'll be killed. So God tries to stop this cycle of killing by saying, well, then anybody who kills you will have seven times vengeance poured on them, in an effort to just stop the activity of human killing. By the way, does it work? No, because threats don't stop sinfulness. You can threaten people all the time. Hey, if you do that, you're going to be in trouble. Kids start out that way. If you do that, you're in trouble. That's a surefire way to get them to do that. They're going to do that. Therefore, whoever kills Cain, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold. And the Lord set a mark on Cain, lest anyone finding him should kill him. We have no idea what that mark is. But throughout the rest of the Bible, you're going to see that God has this habit of marking people. We saw it in the book of Revelation. He marks the 144,000. So the Antichrist marks his in their right hand and their forehead. Jesus comes back with a name written on his thigh and his vestige. No man knows but himself. God has a history of marking because marking shows ownership. So whatever mark he put on Cain, it was a mark from God saying, don't kill him, he's mine. It was that sort of mark. So the Lord set a mark on Cain, lest anyone finding him should kill him. So it's some kind of mark that identified him as someone you don't kill. God has marked him, don't kill him. Verse 16, Cain went out of the presence of the Lord, and he dwelt in the land of Nod on the east of Eden. And Cain knew his wife, and she conceived and bore Enoch. Now we're going to talk seven generations here of the descendants of Cain, the Cainites. And then after seven generations of the Cainites, God doesn't tell us any more about them. And his focus at that point is going to turn to Adam and Eve and their next descendant, Seth. And then he's going to trace the lineage of Seth to head toward Noah, and from Noah forward into Abraham, because God is dealing in the Bible specifically with the seed. He said, the seed of the woman is going to crush the seed of the serpent. And then the rest of the Bible traces the seed, as we're going to see as we work our way through Genesis. This seed language is so important. So I said my next book's going to have to be called Seedology, to trace this seed language, because God is going to say, okay, there's seven generations of Cain, and he's building cities, he's doing fine, he's out there, he's in the world, he's the seed of the serpent, and he takes up the rest of what is known as the world and the people in it. But then he traces the blessed line, the lineage that is going to lead to Christ, the seed, because that's the seed in whom everyone is received, who is received by God. So when people say things like, well, I'm trying to find America in the Bible. If the Bible's that true and accurate, how come it doesn't say anything about the greatest nation on the history of planet Earth? It says nothing about America. Why not? Because that's not what it's about. It also doesn't mention Australia. You can't find a kangaroo or a koala bear in the Bible anywhere. You don't see anything about Eskimos, Red Indians. You don't see anything about the Chinese. Doesn't mention the Japanese. Doesn't mention any of that. Why? Because the Bible is tracing the seed. And if you get that in your head, then you understand that, yes, there are all these other people, the Cainites, the seed of the serpent, and they go out and populate the earth. And they've been there ever since Cain, which is why John would write things later like, love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. For if you love the things of the world, then the love of God is not in you. How can he say that about the world that supposedly Jesus so loved, or that God so loved in John 3:16 that he gave his only son, that whoever believed on him would not perish but have everlasting life? I thought God loved the whole world. No, world inclusive, cosmos, everybody, are those Cainites, the seed of the serpent, who John says we're not to love nor love the things of the world, because the things of the world are not godly. They are the things of the seed of the devil. They are the Cainites. So then should we go and watch how the Cainites act? And how they behave, and how they entertain themselves, and then bring that into our church and use it as a form of worship and think that we can somehow edify or redeem that thing so that we can use it in Christian godly service if God himself didn't introduce it in the first place? Of course not. That seems so obvious, doesn't it? And yet it runs rampant. So, verse 16. Cain went out from the presence of the Lord and dwelt in the land of Nod on the east of Eden, and Cain knew his wife, and she conceived and bore Enoch, and he built a city and called the name of the city after his son Enoch. To Enoch was born Irad, and Irad begot Mahujael, and Mahujael begot Methusael, and Methusael begot Lamech. Then Lamech took for himself two wives. The name of one was Adah, and the name of the other was Zillah. And Adah bore Jabal. He was the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock. His brother's name was Jubal. And he was the father of those who play the harp and the flute. And as for Zillah, she also bore Tubal-Cain, an instructor of every craftsman in bronze and iron. And the sister of Tubal-Cain was Naamah. And Lamech said to his wives, now in some of your texts, this will be sectioned off, paragraphed off, or written as if it's a poem. It's in the form of an ancient Hebrew song, and it has parallel lines of the same idea twice. So it has this Hebrew poetic form to it, and so many of your newer translations will lay it out in poem form. Lamech said to his wives, Adah and Zillah, hear my voice. Here's the parallel. Wives of Lamech, listen to my speech. Same thing said twice. That's the Hebraic poetic structure. For I have killed a man for wounding me, even a young man for hurting me. If Cain shall be avenged sevenfold, then Lamech 77-fold. In other words, here's what's going on.
It got progressively worse.
It got progressively worse, but in this case, he's saying, okay, now he's telling his wives, I've killed a man, but I did it in self-defense. He hurt me, and I ended up killing him. So his argument is, if Cain, who was a murderer, was going to be avenged seven times, and he's a murderer, I committed manslaughter in self-defense, so then I ought to have 77 times, I ought to have far more defense before God than a murderer would have. I mean, if God said, this man's a murderer, but don't kill him, I killed in self-defense. I really ought to be defended. is his basic argument. And then at verse 25, it says, and Adam knew his wife again, and she bore a son and named him Seth. And from that point forward, we leave the Cainites. We've heard what their generations are, and then God just leaves them right there. And he never goes back and picks up that lineage again and tells us, well, what about those people? We just heard, what happens after that? Oh, they get wiped out by the flood. Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Well, now that comes to my next question. If the seed of the serpent is going to be crushed by the seed of man, doesn't the seed of the serpent have to survive the flood, perhaps in the wife of Ham or Japheth?
If not Ham himself.
Well, then...
Doesn't Ham end up under God's curse?
Sure, but Ham's coming from Noah.
Mm-hmm.
So where does the seed of the serpent work into Noah's genealogy?
Sinfulness. The seed of the woman, the blessed seed, is always about election. All human beings are sinful. You don't have to go find the seed of the serpent. That's humanity. The seed of the woman is the blessed seed, the elected seed, the chosen seed. And the only reason I say that is you can't find in the text anywhere where it says that one of the wives did something evil and fell under God's curse. But you definitely find it about Ham. So since Ham falls under the curse, clearly the lineages grow out from there. Right?
I'm just looking to connect Cain with Ham. I mean, isn't it the way lineages go?
Right. I don't think that you need to associate Cain with Ham, because what you've got is Adam and Eve have two sons, right?
Mm-hmm.
One blessed, one cursed.
Right.
So why can't Noah have two sons? One blessed, one cursed.
Sure, but then we're starting a new seed branch as opposed to continuing the seed of the serpent.
Oh, no. I look at it just the opposite. You're saying we would have to start a new branch of the seed in the seed of the serpent. I say no, humanity in its sinfulness is that seed of the serpent, which is why God can take the whole world and speak of them as the world that you're not to love because of the things of the world, God's not in it and stuff, but then can trace the seed, which is the elect, the blessed, the chosen, the called.
Oh, okay.
I mean, Abraham is in Ur of the Chaldees, and he's an idol worshiper, and God calls him.
So the seed of the called then becomes a subset of the much...
Yes.
Okay.
The seed of the called, the seed of the woman, the blessed seed, the blessed lineage, is a subset of
humanity. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is why in the Bible we only read about tracing that seed and not about all of humanity. Right?
That makes sense. I'll go for that.
I'm glad it makes sense. It's the only explanation I've got.
Okay,
one last comment and then we'll wrap it up here for the night. A couple of commentators have made interesting observations about the fact that when we hear about the Cainites and the different generations of the Cainites, they're identified by activity. They're identified by what they do, whether that's tilling soil, whether it's being involved in the arts, whether it's being involved in construction, building cities. But you don't see the same thing when you read about the first generations from Adam. Instead, you read about their relationship to God. You're going to read that language. In fact, here, let's real quickly see that. Adam knew his wife again, and she bore a son named Seth. For God has appointed another seed to me instead of Abel, whom Cain killed. And as for Seth, to him also a man was born, and he named him Enosh. Then men began to call on the name of the Lord. So you never see that phrase when you're looking at the Cainites. Instead, you see the Cainites living in the world without God, having a lot of activity. They do a lot of stuff. They fill up their time. They become industrious. They become like Cain. They get to work. And they do stuff. And they build buildings. And they do arts. And they plant things. And they do stuff. And they inhabit the earth. They become the people of the earth. And they occupy their time with doing earthly things. Because that's all they got. But you don't see the same language when you start tracing the lineage of Seth. Instead, it's about their relationship to God and the various levels and stages of that relationship with God. And I don't think that's an accident. I think Moses was plain to say, these descendants of Cain were always the earthy working people, but they weren't the godly people. But then Seth, who is the chosen seed, the blessed lineage, these are the people who care about the things of God. And it's a very clear contrast in Moses' writing. So this is the book of the genealogy of Adam, chapter 5, verse 1. In the day that God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. He created them male and female, and he blessed them and called them mankind on the day they were created. And Adam lived 130 years and begot a son. Look at the next phrase. What's it say? In his own likeness. Moses didn't miss that point because something changed. Adam was made, according to what he just wrote here in chapter 5, this perfect synopsis. Adam and Eve were made, they were called mankind, and they were made in God's image. And then they had children who were made in Adam's image. And because they were in Adam's image, they were sinners. God made sinless beings. God made innocent beings. But every being that sprang from them after the fall weren't any longer considered in the image of God, pure, perfect, righteous, holy. They were from that point forward in Adam's image. In the early parts of Romans, Paul arguing that all mankind is sinful, his evidence is all mankind dies because by Adam's one sin, death came to all men. And so Paul agrees with this concept presented in the early part of chapter 5 that mankind ever since Adam is not made in God's express image. We are all after Adam's image and therefore all fallen, sinful creatures in deep necessity of a Savior. He lived 130 years and he begot a son after his own likeness, after his image. It's said twice there. In his own likeness, after his own image, and he named him Seth. And after he begot Seth, the days of Adam were 800 years, and he had sons and daughters, so all the days of Adam were 930 years, and he died because he was just tired. I mean, 930 years seems like enough. We're going to pick up there next week, and we'll look at the first seven generations from Adam. And in Enoch, the seventh from Adam, who's going to walk and talk with God and was not because God took him. Again, all the theology, I believe, is laid out in these early chapters of Genesis. And by the time we get to Genesis 12 and the Abrahamic covenant, we have the groundwork for the new covenant. I mean, the early parts of Genesis here are really covering huge theological things, including the seventh from Adam being raptured. I mean, it just gets taken right up off the planet. And we'll look at the New Testament implications of that fact next week.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.